Welcome to The Critique, and today we're looking at the manuscript The Sovereign Enclosure of Life, which basically diagnoses the modern nation-state as a historically constructed container that produces harm when self-maintenance overrides human reality, proposing a framework for life coherent repair.
Right, and jumping straight in, grounding the dense theoretical framework in specific, real-world case studies will make the concept of the life state immediately tangible for the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the foundational diagnosis here is it's incredibly powerful, right? The manuscript maps out how the state transforms living ecosystems into these governable abstractions.
Oh, totally. But I kept waiting for the author to, you know, show me where this new type of governance is actually happening right now. Exactly. Because that's the weakness here. The text introduces these brilliant but, frankly, highly abstract concepts. Things like civil commons constitutionalism and conditional sovereignty.
And bioregional nesting, yeah.
Right. But it lacks extended, concrete examples of these mechanisms functioning in the real world. So the proposed cures end up feeling somewhat utopian, you know, detached from immediate political reality.
Yeah, it's like having this brilliant architectural blueprint for a totally new type of building. And the load-bearing math is completely flawless.
Right.
But the client needs to see a 3D model of a room to truly understand what it feels like to stand inside, you know?
I love that analogy. But I wonder, though, if we've considered whether the sheer scale of the theoretical diagnosis might overshadow the practical messy compromises required to actually implement these cures.
Oh, that's a really fair question. I mean, does mapping out hyper-specific local agreements risk diluting the purity of the high-level theory?
Well, pure theory is great, but the suggestion here is that they really need to integrate focused historical or contemporary examples, places where states or regions or even communities have successfully applied life-coherent principles, just to demonstrate that this political redesign is not just possible, but like already underway in localized forms.
Okay, yeah. So what are some concrete examples of how they could actually do that on the page?
So there's a few possible ways to solve this, right? When discussing bioregional and island-nested governance, they could include a brief case study on how specific cross-border ecological agreements function right now.
Oh, like shared watersheds and stuff?
Exactly. Like the management of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement between the U.S. and Canada. Or transnational coral reef protections.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Because water flows regardless of where we draw a literal line on a map.
Right. And you use those examples to examine the mechanics. How do these agreements actually force sovereign states to subordinate their rigid borders to the reality of a shared ecosystem?
Yeah, that instantly clarifies the theory for me. You're not just saying borders should be porous. You're saying, look, it's already happening right here.
They could point to real-world constitutions that have recognized the rights of nature.
Like the models in Ecuador or Bolivia.
Yes. You bring those in and analyze what worked, and crucially, what challenges remain.
That friction is so important. Analyzing those challenges proves the theory can survive the messy reality of the world. But, you know, that kind of leads us perfectly into the next big issue, because pulling this into the real world means hitting a geopolitical wall.
It really does. And confronting the immediate geopolitical realities of predatory statecraft will fortify the manuscript against the most likely pragmatic criticisms from political realists.
Yeah, because the manuscript makes this incredibly strong case for redefining security, right? Away from enemy production and coercive expansion.
The dissection of the sacrificial citizen is just brilliant.
It really is. This idea that the state requires its citizens to be expendable for its own survival. But, and here's the weakness, it under-addresses the immediate counterargument. How does a life-coherent state protect its civil commons against bad faith, aggressive neighboring states?
Right. States that remain fully committed to coercive expansion.
Exactly. Is there a risk that focusing solely on demilitarized security might overlook the immediate vulnerability of a life state? That makes sense, but could the evidence also support a different conclusion, like the necessity of maintaining robust military deterrence simply to protect the life-coherent state from being swallowed by a war-made state?
That is the exact question a political realist is going to ask by Chapter 12. They're going to say, lovely sentiment, but what stops an autocrat next door from rolling tanks across your newly porous borders?
Right. So what's the suggestion here? How does the author fix this?
The suggestion is to add a dedicated subsection in the cures part of the manuscript that explicitly addresses the transition period and the actual mechanics of self-defense for a life state existing in a hostile, currently Westphalian world.
Okay, but what are some concrete examples of that? How do you defend a state without a massive hyper-militarized army?
Well, there's a few ways to approach this. They could explore how a state prioritizing demilitarized security handles direct military aggression or, you know, cyber warfare from an expansionist neighbor.
So explaining how a peace infrastructure?
Yeah, peace infrastructure. Explaining how it actively resists invasion without adopting the pathology of the war-made state.
Right, right.
They could discuss the role of strategic nonviolent resistance, regional defense pacts, or economic resilience as life-coherent alternatives to traditional deterrence.
I wonder, and this just occurred to me, if there's also an argument about systemic resilience? Because a traditional war state relies on capturing centralized capital, right? You invade to take the central power grid, the capital city.
Oh, absolutely.
But life state, based on the author's own definitions, is highly decentralized. If your energy grid is microgrids and your food is localized, there's no single control room for an invading army to seize.
That is a fantastic angle. Distributing life capacity across the civil commons makes it a logistical nightmare to occupy. So demilitarized security isn't a weakness. It's actually a robust form of deterrence.
Yeah. You just use the manuscript's own logic to answer the realist critique. It honors a protective function of the state without mutating back into a life harm machine.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've grounded the theory in real world examples, and we've bulletproofed it against geopolitical counterarguments. But even if the argument is structurally perfect, there's still a stylistic hurdle here.
There really is.
Streamlining the rich, specialized vocabulary and anchoring it more consistently to the visual diagrams will prevent reader fatigue and clarify the core actionable arguments.
Yeah, because the vocabulary here is a double-edged sword.
It really is. I mean, the vivid, descriptive language is conceptually thrilling. The life harm machine metaphor beautifully captures the tragedy of the state abstracting human life.
It's masterful. But building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the reader's cognitive load? Is the connection between all these new terms fully established, or is that an area to potentially bolster by slowing the pace down?
Oh, it definitely needs slowing down. That's the weakness. The manuscript introduces this massive lexicon of highly original, dense terminology.
Yeah, like sovereign enclosure and bordered moral perception.
Right, and developmental sacrifice, epistemic closure. And while it's intellectually thrilling, stacking these terms so densely in every single paragraph risks overwhelming the reader.
Completely. It risks turning a passionate plea for political redesign into, like, an abstract academic exercise.
I definitely felt that. You hit a sentence with three compound theoretical concepts, and you literally have to stop and reverse engineer the sentence just to understand it.
Exactly. So the suggestion is to introduce key terms more deliberately. Give the reader cognitive breathing room between heavy conceptual drops, and crucially, actively use the existing visual diagrams in the text as recurring anchor points to explain the vocabulary.
Okay, so what are some concrete ways to actually do that pacing on the page?
Well, a few specific approaches could include, let's say they're introducing ecological abstraction in chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just dropping the term in, explicitly refer back to the specific step in figure 2. Like, point them to administrative translation in the diagram to visually ground the cognitive leap.
Oh, that's great, because it gives the reader a visual map for the new language.
Right. And another example for improvement is how they handle summary paragraphs. Instead of listing multiple dense concepts back to back, like saying, you know, from developmental sacrifice to capacity restoration, from institutional denial to learning from the wound.
Yeah, when they stack four paradigm shifts in one sentence, it all just blurs together.
Exactly. So break those down into a narrative progression. Allow the reader to digest one transformation before moving to the next.
Spend a paragraph unpacking what it actually looks like to leave behind developmental sacrifice before dragging them into institutional denial.
Precisely. Let the ideas breathe.
Yeah, clear, accessible communication is kind of a form of civil commons in itself, right?
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Well, let's quickly recap our critique today. We had three core actionable takeaways. First, we need to bridge the gap between abstract theory and practical reality by grounding the abstract cures in real-world case studies.
Right. And second, bulletproofing the demilitarized security argument against the reality of hostile neighbors by adding a dedicated subsection on transition mechanics and self-defense.
Exactly. And third, pacing the introduction of the dense vocabulary and tying it to the visual diagrams to enhance reader retention and reduce fatigue.
Because we want this brilliant framework to be as accessible and impactful as possible.
Completely agree. We'd love to invite the listener to implement these structural and pacing adjustments and submit their revised manuscript back to the critique for another look. Thanks for joining us.